A big new federal lawsuit against banks in the mortgage mess. An embarrassing deception at New York City Hall. A rebel military leader emerges in Tripoli who has quite a history with the United States. And India tries to organize the world's largest biometric database. I'm Pat Lyons with a preview of the front page of Friday's New York Times. In our lead article, Nelson Schwartz reports that federal regulators are about to file suit against more than a dozen large banks, including Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Deutsche Bank, over their role in the mortgage securities mess. The lawsuit will accuse the banks of misrepresenting the quality of mortgage-backed securities that they assembled and sold during the housing bubble. When the bubble burst, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two government-sponsored mortgage giants, lost billions of dollars on the securities, losses that mostly wound up being borne by taxpayers. Now the agency that oversees Fannie and Freddie wants to recover those losses from the banks, saying the banks were careless or reckless in packaging and selling the bonds. Private investors who lost money on the bonds have lodged similar claims, but they mostly want the banks to buy the bonds back. The new suit is seeking cash compensation instead, which could clobber the bank's earnings for years to come. The banks say the lawsuits like this will only set back any recovery in the housing market, which will in turn hurt the broader economy. Why is the suit being filed now? Because a 3-year statute of limitations will expire next week. The administration of New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg acknowledged on Thursday that it hadn't exactly come clean with the public over the departure of a top aide in early August. City Hall said at the time that Stephen Goldsmith, a deputy mayor, had quit to pursue private sector opportunities in infrastructure finance, language that people close to the situation said the mayor had reviewed and approved himself. In fact, Mr. Goldsmith had been arrested a week earlier and spent 48 hours in jail after a heated argument with his wife, an incident that he reported to the mayor immediately after his release. Michael Barbaro writes in the Times that many elected officials in the city are disappointed and a bit alarmed that Mayor Bloomberg would have hidden the true circumstances of Mr. Goldsmith's departure from the public for weeks, especially since he's made government transparency and combating domestic violence major priorities during his tenure. The mayor's office refused to comment, and the Goldsmiths issued a statement denying any violent behavior in their July 30th argument. In Tripoli, Rod Nordland talks to Abdelhakim Belhaj, the man in charge of the rebel military committee that is trying to keep order in the Libyan capital now that Colonel Muammar el-Qaddafi has been driven from power. Mr. Belhaj, a short and serious man of 45, embodies some pretty big contradictions. He's an Islamist who was regarded for years as an enemy of the West in the war on terror, and yet he's been thrust into a position of authority with American and NATO blessing. He concedes that he was the emir of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, a rebel band that the United States deemed to be a terrorist group allied with al-Qaeda, but he says he has no Islamist agenda. He even went through extraordinary rendition. Detained in Malaysia in 2004 and secretly shipped to Thailand at the United States' behest, where he says he was tortured by CIA agents, and then, worse, sent back to Libya, where the Qaddafi regime held him in solitary for 6 years. No hard feelings, though, at least not against the United States and NATO, Mr. Belhaj says. He told Mr. Nordland that he's now a grateful ally of the West, with no interest in revenge. He said a lifetime under Colonel Qaddafi had taught him that nobody should be allowed to make Libya suffer any more for an ideology. A United Nations review has found that Israel's naval blockade of Gaza is legal and appropriate, but it found a lot to criticize in the way Israel has enforced it against a flotilla of ships that tried to sail to Gaza from Turkey 15 months ago. When Israeli forces boarded the flotilla, they used excessive and unreasonable force, according to the report, which is scheduled for release on Friday. 9 passengers on the flotilla were killed in the incident after commandos boarded the main ship, where the report found that they faced organized and violent resistance. While the commandos were justified in defending themselves, the loss of life was unacceptable, and the way the Israelis treated everyone else in the flotilla afterward was abusive, the report said. Neil McFarquhar and Ethan Bronner write that the UN report was completed months ago, but publication was delayed several times to give Turkey and Israel a chance to patch up relations that were badly frayed by the flotilla incident. Both governments objected to the report's conclusions. The Turkish side is upset at the finding that Israel had the right to stop would-be blockade runners in international waters, while Israel rejects claims that its commandos reacted too violently. In Washington, everybody's wondering about the speech on jobs that President Obama now plans to deliver next Thursday. Will he highlight his sharp differences with Republicans on what is best for the economy, or will he take the pragmatic road and stick to ideas that he thinks will attract Republican votes in Congress? Jackie Combs writes that the challenge for the president is to somehow do both. Another display of bitter partisan gridlock, like the one over the debt ceiling, will probably just spook the credit agencies in the bond market, Ms. Combs writes. But the kinds of measures that might find bipartisan support, like tax credits for expanding companies, are not likely to bring the big jumps in job creation that the economy needs. And politically, they aren't likely to satisfy progressives, who are calling with increasing urgency for aggressive New Deal-style spending programs to put lots of people back to work. The congressional Republicans, who insist on budget cuts to keep any new measure from increasing the deficit, a demand they never made for the Bush tax cuts, say that ideas like that have no chance of passing. Finally, in the third installment of the Times' series India's Way, Lydia Polgreen writes about a huge project to assemble a database of identifying information, dates of birth, fingerprints, iris scans, for all the country's 1.2 billion people. As part of the project, everybody in India will get a unique 12-digit ID number that is meant to help them gain access to welfare benefits, to open bank accounts, and to do business far from their home villages, the way a Social Security number does in the United States. Without the database, people in India often have a hard time establishing their identity or obtaining government benefits anywhere they are not known personally, which makes it hard to move from one part of the country to another and traps people in pockets of poverty. What we're creating is as important as a road, says Nandan Nilekani, the billionaire software mogul who oversaw the design of the database. It is a road that in some sense connects every individual to the state. Organizers hope that the database will also help root out inefficiency and corruption in welfare programs and spread the gains from economic growth more widely. One cannot improve human beings, said the director of the project, but one can certainly improve systems. And that's a preview of the front page of Friday's New York Times. For more on these and other stories, pick up a copy of the paper or visit nytimes.com. From the New York Times newsroom, I'm Pat Lyons.